Last week, we finished up on where we find the scriptures, how they came to us, how they were transmitted to us, how we decide which manuscripts are correct. This week, we're going to start talking about science and the Bible. And as you can imagine, there's enough material there to cover several semesters, you know, and we're not going to cover it all. But I think there's some critical points we do want to make sure you get into it, because in today's age, you cannot get far discussing the Bible with anyone who's not, you know, born a Christian without pretty quickly getting into the question of how science and the Bible fit together, right? And before we get into any of the details, and there are plenty of details to talk about, we need to talk about first, take kind of a global or bigger view, right? Back up and look. And the part that we all have, the when we deal with science and religion, Christianity in particular, the part that almost always gets skipped in the discussion is what anthropologists, philosophers, theologians call worldview. Right? Our worldview is how we look at the world, but it's the part of how we look at the world that is typically unexamined, because it's so much a part of who we are and how we think that we really can't imagine someone thinking another way. So, you know, in a typical Christian atheist discussion on the internet, or in high school or at work, you know, the atheist says, "I don't believe the Bible's inspired," and the Christian says, "But look, these verses say that it's inspired." Right? Well, the Christian's worldview assumes that, you know, Scripture is authoritative, and so that proves it. Of course, it's to the atheist, that's entirely circular, right? Why would I care that it says it's inspired unless I believe it's inspired and you haven't persuaded me? So what a silly argument that is. You know, because in the atheistic worldview, Scriptures are just an ancient manuscript written by, you know, people long ago that has very little to do with us or anything that matters. So quoting the Scripture to prove something is nonsense. Right? Whereas to a Christian, it's ultimate proof. And we can become so unaware of our underlying assumptions that we can't even talk to people outside the church. So it's important to see the difference. The other problem that comes up is, of course, that I think is a pretty good case to be made that in the United States, there's really only two worldviews going on. There's the Christian worldview, there's the naturalist worldview. I mean, you know, Muslims have a different worldview. There are, you know, groups that have it, but within the majority of the country, those are the two worldviews, and very few people are strictly one or the other, right? I mean, a Christian is going to be, to some extent, secularized. We've got a lot of the secular assumptions in our thinking and don't recognize it, so we don't truly have a completely Christian worldview. And you talk to someone who claims to be an atheist, it won't be long before you realize he's actually got some of the Christian worldview in him that he can't defend from his perspective. So rarely do you run into somebody who's actually purely one or purely the other. We're all kind of blends of one or the other, which makes the conversation all the more difficult, because we find ourselves agreeing at surprising points, you know, or sometimes we agree with things as Christians that we really should not agree with. But we haven't ever examined it until we're talking to somebody coming from a very different worldview. And here in the South, here in the Deep South, so many people are in fact Christian, or at least they come from a Christian culture, right? That they think Christian to a degree. And those people here who are truly atheist have learned better than to talk much about it, because it doesn't go well, right? So we don't have that much practice at it. Which is why some of these conversations happen in high school. That's before people learn better, you know. Society doesn't accept, you know, don't talk about religion and politics, right? And atheism is a religion kind of thing. It just gets you in trouble. And yet, to be, you know, effective evangelist, we have to know what we're talking about. We have to be able to communicate with people who are outside of our perspective. If you're my age, I'm 60, I grew up in a world where nearly everybody went to church, or at least knew they were supposed to be in church. Right? World has changed a lot. And so the conversations have become more difficult in a sense, but no longer is it, you need to believe my particular denominational point of view as opposed to your denominational point of view. It's really, you need to believe in God and Jesus. That means, so all those proof texts we learned growing up about why we're right and they're wrong and they are, other denominations, not nearly as useful today as knowing, how do you talk about God when all our lives, the assumption has been, well, of course there's a God and of course the Bible is true. The question is how to correctly interpret the silences, as opposed to, but when you get talking outside of your worldview, then the questions become very different. Back in the 70s and 80s, we used to have film strips, and back then film strips were actually on film, by a guy named Francis Schaeffer. Some of you will remember that. I studied him in college at Lipscomb in about 77 or so. And it's one of the few college level courses I took in college. it was challenging material, but revolutionary in that what Schaeffer did, his ministry, and he worked out of Switzerland, so Europe was way ahead of the United States in having to deal with some of these questions. His ministry was talking to people who have a secular worldview, right, and explaining to the church why this is a problem and going to get worse and why you need to be able to talk about it and think about it and what's going on. And the way Schaeffer did it was through culture. He would talk about the Renaissance paintings and what they meant and work his way all the way through up to the Beatles at that time and explain how Western assumptions have changed and how our thinking about God and man have changed. And our culture has changed because our arts have changed and how deeply influenced we are by art. Okay? Nowadays, of course, in the paper, it's no longer subtle, right? You don't get it in the lyrics of the Beatles. You get it from Richard Dawkins and such, who write books plainly saying, God does not live, never has lived, not going to live, and this is how you need to think and be. Right? So the conflict is now much more out in the open. Which would not have been, those kind of books were published in the 50s and 60s, but nobody read them much. Right now they're bestsellers. And one approach to apologetics, the technical term is presuppositional apologetics, which is a terrible term, and the people who teach it say this is a terrible term, and it is because it doesn't really tell you what's going on, right? What's going on is the idea that we need to first engage people of a different worldview, not through Scripture, because they don't believe in Scripture, right? Not through disproving evolution, but through discussing the really big issue of the time, which is differing worldviews. Yeah, and the point is, ultimately, I may not be able to prove it in a scientific sense, because it's bigger than science. See, science is a product of a particular worldview. I can show you that the Christian worldview is a better explanation for what we experience as humans than the secular worldview. And actually, it's not that difficult a case to make. It's just that we never think at that level, okay? When somebody brings up evolution, our first reaction is to say, oh, the earth was made in 6 days, it's not true, and go through all the elaborate arguments about that. And, there is no end to the arguments. And they're, frankly, not that persuasive. And they're not really the point. We'll talk about evolution more as we get on. But for now, really the point is, think about it this way. If there is no God, then where did we come from? Well, we're evolved, right? And how did that happen? Well, there was a random fluctuation in something not yet discovered that caused the universe to burst into existence in a big bang, and then there was a period of hyperinflation for reasons we don't really understand that made it go really big and really fast and created lots and lots of matter. It became huge. And then in an amazing set of unbelievable coincidences, particles came into existence that became atoms, which became molecules, which in a random series of events in some pool somewhere on the planet Earth happened to form an RNA molecule that has enough information in it to code for a cell. And then that evolved into us. Okay? Well, that's a great story, isn't it?
Got it.
Okay. Now, just all kinds of difficulties with that, but there's a bigger problem with that other than the obvious difficulties is, well, if that's true, then who am I? Right? Well, I'm the product of a purposeless random event, if actually, lots and lots of random events, and I am not the purpose of creation, right? I'm just a random outcome. And so what value do I have in the grand scheme of things? The answer is none. What makes some things right and some things wrong? Well, nothing. And I'm not saying this to challenge philosophy. This is philosophy, okay? I mean, this is the only answers you can come up with. So what is my hope for an afterlife? Well, what a ridiculous thing. That is a superstition that humans built to help them cope with a difficult world with thunder and lightning and volcanoes and things. And so we were terrified, and so we made up a story, and it fed our insecurities. And that gave us an evolutionary advantage because hope helped us build communities, which helped us survive and create the society we now live in. But it's not true, right? So the very things that allow us to be human are lies we tell ourselves, but they're convenient because they allow us to survive and thrive and ultimately, in the Darwinian sense, propagate and have another generation with our genes in them, right? Very depressing philosophy. I mean, it's just awful. So you ask the philosophers of the age, well, if that's the case, then how should I live? And, one answer that was given 100 years ago is, well, take a blind leap of faith. The phrase blind leap of faith is not a Christian phrase, all right? It is an atheistic phrase. It's a secular phrase. It says there is no rational place to go to find a way to be and to live. Rationality tells us there's no hope, that there's no morality, that there's no value. We can't live that way. We're not made to be that way. So we'll take a leap and land somewhere else, which might be Christianity, and some people do that. Or it might be hedonism. Eat, drink, and be merry. It might be lots of different things. It might be I'm just not going to think about it, which is a very popular choice, actually. Right? But that is, a very common choice, right? In kind of the postmodern take on this, we conclude, well, we can't really even communicate with each other. Verbal communication is so imprecise that it's so subjective that the real knowledge is in the hearer, and we bring the truth to the party ourselves. We don't get it from somebody else. And that, of course, is utter nonsense, right? But it makes sense in a world without meaning. Right? Where can meaning even come from if there's no meaning to start with, right? We have to bring it to the party. And who are we to bring meaning? We're just something that happened to survive out of the primordial ook. Ook is a technical term. And out of this arises, moral, the philosophy of moral relativism and cultural relativism, right, which are very popular on campuses. Who am I to tell someone what they should think? And in fact, we are nobody to tell somebody what to think. That's God's place. If you don't believe in God, then there is nobody to tell other people what to think, right? What makes me a moral arbiter over you? I'm just not. But even the most morally relativistic person and those who are so clear that you've got no right to tell me how to live my life, right? And nor should we tell other cultures how to live their lives, and we should respect other cultures, right? There's always a hot button issue where that just flips the other way, and they become the most arrogant, condescending, judgmental people on the planet, right? So, we the United States go out and defeat Afghanistan and Iraq. Well, we're going to tell them how to treat their women. All right, well, I think they treat their women wrong because God said so. Well, if you're a moral relativist, if you're a cultural relativist, you've got no right to do that. Right? They get to make their own choice. That's their religion. That's how they've chosen to live. Who are we to tell them that? And the answer is, we are the people with the better weapons. Right? And yes, we're going to tell them that. You know, and making judgments about all kinds of moral issues, which ought to be judged, right? Those questions ought to be asked. Is this a war we ought to fight? Well, the secular community often is quicker to ask that question than the Christian community. It's just that the Christians actually have a basis on which to make that judgment, and the secularists don't, right? So anytime you speak to someone in that, I mean, they come out and you get these ridiculous answers like, well, we get to decide what's right and wrong. Well, no, there's no we. You get to decide what's right and wrong for you and your system, but how do you tell me what's right and wrong? Well, we're going to form a society that has a government and work through government. Well, I mean, you can do that, right? But what if I don't want to be a part of that? Again, who are you to tell me I don't want to do that? And besides, how do we then decide who to vote for? Because right and wrong is what Congress decides, which means the present is right and we can't make something better because there is no such thing as better, it's undefined. Right. So this is what, you know, the modern mind has to wrestle with. And there's just all kinds of answers given for it, and none of them are very good. But it's a popular point. N.T. Wright likes to point out that this is not a new point of view. You can go back to before Jesus. There was a Greek philosopher who said, we're made of nothing but atoms. Different kinds of substances, different kinds of atoms, but they're just kind of randomly bumping around each other at a level too small for us to see. Very smart these Greeks were, right? But because we're just a collection of atoms, then there's nothing there other than atoms, and therefore there are no gods. Or if there are gods, why would they care about us? They're worried about things like building mountains or making planets, you know, but not us. We're too small for the gods to be concerned with. So don't pray to the gods, don't sacrifice to the gods, don't worry about the afterlife. There is no afterlife. The guy was named Epicurus, founded the philosophical school of Epicureanism, which is eat, drink, and be merry, which was a great philosophy, very popular, called on Wells, bestseller, among the upper classes because they could do it. They could eat, drink, and be merry because they had slaves, right? You know, but among the lower classes, it's like, what eat, drink, and be merry? I can barely feed my family to survive till next week. Did not catch on with them. A philosophy without hope other than in the present life is only a good philosophy if you really like the present life, right? So, you know, the slaves and the freedmen and the laborers, not so good with that. But among the wealthy classes, the aristocracy, that was it. You know, we'll just have the slaves do all the work and have a good life. Then we'll die. So that philosophy is not built on the scientific evidence of Darwinianism and Newtonian physics and relativity, right? It goes back over 2,000 years. Part of what has made it popular, though, is in America, we have the good life, right? And most, not everybody, but far more people today than in ancient Greece can actually eat, drink, and be merry. Standard of living has increased dramatically, making that kind of a philosophy more popular. And why do I need a hope in the afterlife when this life is actually a pretty good one? I think I'll just stick with it. And don't tell me how to live my life. All So the Christian worldview is different. And like I say, we're not real good at it. You know, we've got weaknesses or gaps. For example, you know, Book of Romans is one of those books where Paul really explains it in detail, right? And it's really hard to follow. It's a very difficult book for most of us, I think for all of us. And but in chapter 1, Paul makes this point. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them, for his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world into things that have been made, so they are without excuse. So Paul says, and this is the Jewish worldview that the Christians adopted, if you want to learn about God, you're not blessed to have the law of Moses or other scriptures. That's okay. You can learn about God from what God made, right? If you study the paintings of Picasso, you can learn something about Picasso. You know, if you study Van Gogh, you can see the man was crazy, right? Brilliant, but crazy. It's there. There's something about Monet that was special, right? Everybody loves Monet. If you read someone's writings, you can learn a lot about the author. And you can try to hide yourself, but, you know, you write enough, eventually it all comes out. So, you know, an artist can be discerned through his work, not perfectly, right, but his heart can be seen, right? So by looking at the creation, you can see the heart of God. And yet, there's a substantial element of Christianity that teaches, no, the creation was made by Satan or corrupted by Satan so that you can't see God in it. Only through the scriptures, not through creation. Yeah, so don't get out your microscopes and look at the little things, because that's dangerous. And sure, don't get out your telescopes and look at things that are more than 6,000 light years away, because that doesn't tell you about God. See the problem? The Bible says, look at the creation and see God. And what Isaac Newton, who is a deeply convicted Christian, did in order to discover the laws of planetary motion and invent science and calculus while he was at it. What Newton did was he said, I'm going to look at creation and find God. The early scientists were Christians, and they came to their conclusions because they believed in God. So Newton figured, God, the scriptures say God is unchanging. Well, if there are laws out there that govern how things behave, then they are unchanging laws. So the fact that it may be happening, you know, millions of miles away, it doesn't change. It doesn't change with time. It doesn't change with distance. God is the same God here forever. The Bible says that. So therefore, I should be able to discern laws of nature that are from God that do not change. And that led to the idea that maybe we should look for mathematical formulas, because Newton was a mathematician, and hence the laws of planetary motion and science was invented by Newton. But it was based on a Christian worldview. Now, you know, non-Christian scientists still do science today, but they're building it on assumptions that are fundamentally Christian. Because why else would it be that there might be, what tells us that it should make sense? So I don't want to go looking unless I think there's a decent chance that there's something to find. And why should it make sense? Well, because God is a rational God. So to Christians, of course it should make sense, right? And why is it worth my time and trouble to go study these things when it's not obvious that there's some, you know, application to life today about how Mars goes around the sun? Well, because it's part of the handiwork of God, right? And so I will find beauty and encouragement and even hope in that somehow if I study it. That's the Christian perspective, whereas, you know, scientists do it because you get grants and because it's fun and, you know, they enjoy it, but it's not about ultimate things. It's so two very different perspectives. And yet, look around the United States today, the great scientific institutions are secular. Right? The great Christian universities don't do much science research. I'm sure there are exceptions. I haven't been able to think of any. You know, we're kind of afraid of science. We're afraid of what we might learn, afraid about, you know, contradict God, which means we don't really believe the scriptures. which means our worldview is a bit askew. Okay? Psalm 19 begins, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words whose voice is not heard." Right? So get out my telescope, go look at distant galaxies, I should see here the voice of God. So says David. Right? Well, if that doesn't fit in my worldview, well, that's from God. That's right. Somehow I'm wrong. So all too often, these debates between the Christian worldview and the secular worldview is about, am I for science, against science? Are scientists good people? Are they horrible people trying to destroy all faith in God? Right? When it just can't be. You know, now how we reconcile scientific studies with what we read in the scriptures is a question we'll talk about. Well, we have to start with, you know, a faith commitment that it fits. It has to be. And then, if we're willing to really believe it, then the scriptures tell us, you know, one of the great difficulties, you see this in the American political system, you see it in lots of things that get talked about. Outside of Christianity, there's a debate over whether man is fundamentally good or fundamentally bad. Lord of the Flies, we read in high school. You know, the Republicans tend to see man as bad. We don't trust man, and so therefore we're not going to give him power in government. And we're going to limit the government because we don't trust, because people are subject to corruption. That's true, to a degree. The Democrats tend to think, well, humans are perfectible, and if they can pass a civil service exam and get elected to office, then they can tell us how to live our lives. And no more diets, no more sugar sodas. By the way, sugar really is bad for you. But I don't know this is government's place to tell you that, you know. I don't know that I'm going to give them that much power over their lives, because I tend to think people can mess up, and giving them a government job doesn't make them all of a sudden superhuman, right? But that's the difference, right? Are people really good? If people are really good, then we can give them power and let them tell us how to live our lives. We'll be better. Which seems hopelessly naive, right? But on the other hand, the idea that, well, we don't need anybody to tell us what to do, well, that's hopelessly naive, too. There are bad people out there. I've met them, and we need the police. We really do. But in a secular world, you can't even define good and bad. I mean, you don't even know how to talk about it. Well, the Christian worldview is neither of those two. And it hasn't made its way into the political system, which should caution you, okay? The secular worldview is, the Christian worldview is, man created us, and we were, once Eve was made, very good. It was not good for man to be alone, but he made Eve, then it was very good. Not perfect, but really good. And then sin entered the world, and we became broken. Some years ago, we studied the series The Blue Parakeet and called us broken icons. We're images of God. We'll talk more about that, but we're images of God. We are God's representation in the creation to show what God is like, and we are broken and we're not very good at it. But we've still got in us some godness. So humans are capable of great goodness. But we're broken, and so humans are capable of great badness. Right? We're both. And that's actually a pretty accurate description of the human condition. Right? I mean, just because it was written 3,500 years ago, long time ago, by people in the Bronze Age, doesn't mean they're ignorant of humanity. So Epicureanism is not new. Neither is this worldview. It's really quite an old one. So people are broken. They aspire to be better. And then the other part of it is, and this is where, you know, the science thing comes in, is the universe, we can call it an open universe, which is God is concerned about what's going on in the universe he made and is capable of entering it. And in fact, he does that on a regular and recurring basis, in fact, all the time. Now, the Christian perspective, in kind of popular Christian behavior, is God does that on rare occasion. I mean, there's even in the Churches of Christ a strain of thought that says that, you know, all miracles stopped 2,000 years ago, God's no longer much interested in us. Right? It's deistic. That is a secular perspective brought into the church. It's a corruption. The Christian perspective is God's always involved in everything. Hebrews chapter 1, verse 3. Start at verse 1. Hebrews 1, 1. Long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets, but in the last days he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed the heir of all things, through whom also he created the world. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature, and he upholds the universe by the word of his power. Not only was the universe made through Jesus, but Jesus' present tense, continuous, upholds the universe. He holds it together. The Greeks had an idea for this. The Stoics called it. Had figured out that there are laws of nature. Again, Greeks, very smart people. And they said, you know, there can be laws of nature that say how things happen. But what is it that makes the laws true? Right? I mean, just write an equation on a piece of paper doesn't make it happen. Or what makes it happen? And they said, well, it's kind of the power behind the gods, it's the stuff of the universe. They called it the Logos. Right? So in John chapter 1, where we're told in the beginning was the Word, the Logos, and the Word was God, was with God. That's grabbing into a Greek philosophical concept as well as some Jewish concepts, blending them all together, but the Greek part of it is behind everything that happens is the will of God through Jesus. Why is the law of gravity what it is? Because Jesus wills it. Well, what would happen if Jesus were to stop willing it? Well, there'd be no more gravity. It's actually something that scientists and philosophers think about. Doesn't make it much into the popular press, but there's a strange thing about the laws of nature. If you try to run the math on a lot of things, fairly simple things, the math gets really complicated really fast. When I was in college, I was learning how to program in Fortran, a now largely forgotten language. We didn't have monitors, we used punch cards. And I arrogantly thought, I think I'll write a program for how to play pool, right? A little ball hits 15 balls and they scatter off in the various directions, bounce off the cushions and slow down because of the friction. And it took, you know, like 3 minutes to realize there is no way on God's green earth I'm ever going to write this program on punch cards. You know, it's just so incredibly complicated. Yeah, even if you make a lot of simplifying assumptions, just playing pool. Really complicated, right? And yet the billiard balls can do it with no brains at all. Right? How does the cue ball know? I mean, I can write the equations for it, maybe fill up the board and not be quite right, but I mean, the math is well known. The physics are very well known. We even understand the structures within the cue ball that make it be elastic and such, right? My son's a chemical engineer, and he could tell you in great detail how that works at the quantum level. Right? But why does it work? And how does it know? Right? How can you have these differential equations that science, that mathematicians scratch their heads over and spend hours to solve, and in a nanosecond it does it? Right? What, as to quote Stephen Hawking, who's an atheist, but he's an honest atheist, right? And he asked the question, what puts the fire in the equations, right? How is it that we're able to describe it mathematically, but that is not what causes it? It can't be what causes it. It requires a supercomputer in every atom. No room for it. Won't fit. No place to plug it in. Right? Can't be done. And yet the atoms know how to behave in a way that would take a supercomputer to calculate. For some reason, we live in a universe that's comprehensible to our primate minds. Why would we have evolved something that's able to understand, to a degree, not completely, the Big Bang? How does that have survival advantage? And so the philosophers wrestle with this because to them it doesn't quite make sense. I mean, there's no explanation for it. It's obviously true. You have to deal with the obvious truth. But why it's true, they don't know. And to a Christian, it's like, of course. Right? We're in the image of God. God made it. He understands it. He made it in a way that could be understood because he wanted his children to see something of the universe the way he sees it. Right? So when we get out the telescopes and the microscopes, and for that matter, the steam shovels, and dig deep into the earth and find all this stuff, we're starting to see the universe the way God sees it. Here's the only discussion question of the hour. Why did God make dinosaurs? I mean, they're not going to be in heaven or hell. You would think T-Rexes ought to be in hell because they look really evil. But they're not. What was the point? I'm not sure that's really where oil came from. Maybe one day we'll discover exactly where oil comes from. But that's probably not why he made dinosaurs. It is my view that he made dinosaurs because it was just a whole heck of a lot of fun. Right? God is a creative being. Those of us who are creative, which is really all of us, some more than others, we take delight in making new things. Why would God not be the same way? I'd even take it, I raised four boys, right? I think God made dinosaurs to give delight to elementary age little boys. Because they love dinosaurs, love, love, love dinosaurs. I mean, oh, we got a warehouse full of dinosaur toys, you know? And that sounds frivolous and silly, right? Because to us, it's like, that's a lot of waste of time and energy and effort. Well, not if you're God, right? God's got all the time, got more time than is in the world, right? He's not going to run out of time. He's not going to run out of energy. He's not going to run out of curiosity. He's not going to run out of the opportunity to be creative and to delight in things. There's no need for him to be efficient. And it was just, you know, a whole heck of a lot of fun, I think. I'm open to other suggestions, but I really enjoyed Jurassic Park myself. I got it on Blu-ray. It's a great show, right? Because I grew up on dinosaurs, right? And so, you know, we get so kind of taciturn and dried up and don't want to really enjoy this stuff because it's not Christian. And that's, you know, dead wrong, right? You know, God made us to be creative. I just read an article the other day. It says, you know, you would think in the Christian worldview the most important thing would be faith in Jesus. Right? That's really important, he says. But actually, I think more important than faith in Jesus is imagination. Because unless we can imagine things like the resurrection, like the creation, like all of this stuff, we can't believe it. Right? So next week, we're going to talk about the creation chapter in the scriptures, which is Psalm 104 and Job 9. You wish to read ahead?